David is away this weekend attending his 35th college reunion, which has gotten me thinking back to my own college days. I sometimes like to tell people that my claim to fame is having gone to school with my college classmate, Hollywood actor Matt Damon. I remember a conversation with a mutual friend of ours a year or so after graduation. We were talking on the phone, catching up on each other's lives and on what other friends and college classmates were up to. My friend said, "Well, Johnny D got a job teaching history and is coaching sailing, and he's loving it. And Karen's in DC working as a lab assistant and applying to med schools. And oh, I heard Matt Damon is working on writing some screenplay." Well, it turns out that a few years after our phone conversation, Matt won an Oscar for that screenplay in 1997, along with his best friend, fellow actor, and co-writer Ben Affleck. Their screenplay became the movie Good Will Hunting, in which they co-star alongside Robin Williams, who also won an Oscar that year as Best Supporting Actor in the film. The movie centers on the life of 20-year-old Will Hunting, who's a resident of South Boston, played by Damon. A self-taught genius gifted with a brilliant photographic mind capable of solving the most complex mathematical problems, Will mops floors for a living at MIT and spends his free time hanging out and drinking with his buddies in town, including his best friend Chucky, who's played by Affleck. A series of events unfolds, which results in Will engaging in a therapeutic relationship with a psychologist, Dr. Sean McGuire, played by Robin Williams, who helps Will look at past trauma from his childhood and to explore what might be keeping him from pursuing a career that would put his brilliant mind to use and keep him from truly investing in intimate, life-giving relationships. Despite this work with his psychologist, Will continues to balk at making changes in his life. He passes up job interviews and job offers, including an opportunity to work for the NSA, which is arranged with the help of McGuire's friend, an MIT professor who discovered Will. And Will sabotages his new budding romantic relationship with a beautiful, kind, and intelligent woman. There's this dramatic climactic scene towards the end of the movie when Will and his best friend Chucky are having this conversation, and Chucky is challenging Will and asking Will why he doesn't take up these job offers and these job interviews seriously. Why doesn't he take them seriously? And Will looks at Chucky and says, "Well, but Chucky, I'm going to stay with you in this neighborhood for the rest of my life. I want our kids to grow up together. I want them to play softball together. We're together. We're going to stay in this neighborhood together." Chucky looks at Will with horror on his face, and he says to his best friend, "You know, if you don't do it for yourself, you've got to do it for me and for our other buddies. We would give anything to have your mind and to have the shot of making something great with our lives. Don't tell me that you're going to stay in this neighborhood." And then he goes on to tell his best friend, "The best part of my day, Will, is those 10 seconds, the first thing in the morning when I drive up to your house in my car and I'm waiting for you to come out to take you to work. And in those 10 seconds when I'm waiting for you, I think that maybe, just maybe, he won't come out because you're not there, because you've actually left town without even saying goodbye to go find your real life." What keeps individuals stuck in patterns and habits of living that aren't life-giving? Stuck in patterns and habits that don't lead to true fulfillment, healing, and wholeness? What keeps people walking around and around on the same circular trail at the base of a mountain instead of venturing onto a new path that would help them to ascend? What keeps us from rising? In today's gospel, we hear the story of a man who has been ill for 38 years. We don't know in this story exactly what's wrong with him. We just know he's been sick for that long. And here's the scene. He is one of tens, perhaps hundreds of other invalids we hear, the lame, the blind, the paralyzed, and they're all lying under one of five porticos to be in the shade and be sheltered from that Middle Eastern sun. This portico and these set of porticos, we're told, are porticos that are by the sheep's gate, which is the gate through which the sheep that are going to be sacrificed as rituals in the temple of Jerusalem enter the town. Biblical commentators talk about how the sheep that entered through the sheep's gate before going off to the temple were washed on one side of the pool, and that there was also a legend that said that an angel of the Lord periodically would come down from heaven to touch the waters of the pool and to trouble the waters. And at the first sign of the troubling of the waters, the first person or the first sick person to get down to the waters after they had been troubled by the angel would be healed and be made well. So that's why all these people from all around town who were ill with some disease were gathered and would wait under the shade of the portico for the first sign of the troubling of the waters. Now, it's probably safe to assume that this particular man in today's gospel has been sick since childhood, for his whole life, in fact, because at that time, the average life expectancy was about 35 years old. Now, that age is a little bit misleading because it takes into account the high infant mortality rate. So if you actually made it past infancy, and maybe if you were a Roman and in the ruling class, you might live up to your mid-50s. So this man had been sick for 38 years. He'd been sick for most of his life. Had he been coming to the pool for his whole life? Or had he just started coming recently? Again, we can't know for sure. But more likely than not, he is and has been a pool regular for a while. So what's different about this day? How is this day different than all the other days that he's been there? Jesus is there. Jesus is present. And for some reason, Jesus singles out this particular individual. We're told that Jesus knows this man has had this condition for a long time and that he approaches the man. And he asks him, "Do you want to be made well? Do you want to be made well?" Now, I find this to be an odd question at first, don't you? Do you want to be made well? Well, if I were the man, I would have said something like, "Well, with all due respect, Jesus, yes. Of course I want to be made well. I've been sick practically my whole life. Don't you think I want to be made well? What kind of a question is that?" But as with any master teacher, Jesus is masterful at asking just the right probing question. And there is, of course, more to his question than one might think at first hearing. You see, when Jesus asked the man, "Do you want to be made well?" Jesus is also asking, "Do you want to be healed?" Not cured, not fixed. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be made whole? Are you ready for change? Are you ready to be transformed? Do you really want your life as you know it to change and to be transformed? You've been on the margins of society your whole life, in fact. Are you really ready to be restored and reintegrated back to society? Your identity has been the sick one, the diseased one, the infirmed one, the one on that blue mat under portico number 3. Are you really ready to take on a new identity? When Jesus asks, "Do you want to be made well?" he's really asking, are you really ready to no longer be defined by your illness and to have your relationships with others redefined and changed and restored and reimagined to something totally new? You've been cared for your whole life. Are you ready to care for and to serve others? Are you ready to leave and venture off to reimagine and recreate a new life and to engage and be engaged in the world and in your community in an entirely new and different way? Do you want to be made well? You'll notice that the man doesn't answer Jesus' question directly. Instead, he explains the ongoing challenges and difficulties that he has getting to those healing waters. "Well, I don't have anyone to carry me to the pool," he says. "And when I try to make my own way to the pool, other people get in front of me and they get in my way." What's Jesus' response? "Forget about the pool. Forget about the other people. Listen to me. I believe in you. Rise, take up your mat, walk." Those of us who suffer from the disease of addiction of any kind, or who care about someone who suffers from the disease of addiction, understand the power and the challenge of Jesus's question, "Do you want to be made well? Do you really want to be made well?" Because to rise, to take up your mat and to walk, means to rise and to get up off that bar stool. It means to put down the bottle and to pick up the phone and call your sponsor when you're feeling the urge to slip. It means some relationships and some friendships need to die so that new ones that support recovery can be cultivated. It means working and walking those steps to recovery, healing, and wholeness, all 12 of them, step by step, one by one, in order. Beginning with that first step, admitting to ourselves that we are powerless over alcohol or powerless over fill in the blank, and that our lives have become unmanageable, and then moving on to step number two, believing that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, and then moving on to steps 3 and 4 and 5, all the way up through 12. These 12 steps of recovery provide a structure, they provide a path, they point the way. But it's we ourselves who must take the steps and do the work, or our loved ones who must take those steps themselves. As most of you know, I think, or many of you know, in just a few days, on the 1st of June, I will begin my summer sabbatical with plans to return to work towards the end of August. And as I wrote in eRedeemer last week, when people ask me, "What are you going to do on your sabbatical?" my truthful answer is not very exciting, nor is it very inspiring. My plan simply is to rest, to spend time enjoying my family, to reflect on the past 9 years of serving in ordained ministry as a priest here at the Church of the Redeemer, and to dream about the next 9. My plan is to rest and also to heal, to tend to physical, emotional, and spiritual needs that need to be tended to. And in particular, I will be very intentional about focusing on and addressing an issue that I thought I had only been struggling with recently, this past year, whereas in reality, it's an issue that I've been actually living with and managing for most of my life since childhood, and that issue is anxiety. Until this past year, if you'd asked me, "Do you consider yourself to be an anxious person? Do you suffer from anxiety?" I would have answered immediately, "Nope." Nor have I ever in my whole life. But like the man under the portico by the Bethesda pool lying on his mat, like the character Will in Goodwill Hunting, and like my friends and the people whom I care about who suffer from addiction, I too have been living with something for most of my life that is in need of healing. And this hard work of healing will involve me giving up and surrendering some old habits and ways of thinking and reimagining new ones. It'll take me looking at some old wounds and some trauma from my own childhood with the help of a therapist so I can be free from their power over me as an adult. And it will entail me venturing off a circular trail to try a new path and to ascend to a different height. It'll mean me hearing and answering the call of my Lord as best I can and with his grace to rise, take up your mat, walk. At the end of the movie, Good Will Hunting, Chucky, Will's best friend, drives up to Will's house one morning, as is his habit, to pick him up and take him to work. Chucky waits his usual 10 seconds. Will does not come out. He waits another 10 seconds, still no Will. Chucky waits and waits and waits, and finally, with a mixture of disbelief and joy, Chucky realizes that Will isn't home. And if you haven't seen the movie, I commend it to you to discover where Will has gone. I'd like to end with a simple prayer that's familiar to many of you. It's well known to people in recovery and conveys the heart and the hope of the gospel message today, that when it comes to being healed, to being made well and being made whole, which is different, again, than being cured and being fixed, while there are always circumstances beyond our control, there is also always a way for us to venture on, a path for us to follow, steps that we can take, if we would but rise, take up our mat, and walk. The Serenity Prayer. Lord, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.